Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. In the wake of the jury's conviction of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin for the death of George Floyd, whose killing prompted national protests and reforms, we'll have some reactions here in California from Public News Service, followed by an East County Magazine report on reactions from local racial justice advocates and elected officials across the San Diego County region. Next up, we'll have a report on growing efforts to oppose the state's proposed placement of two sexually violent predators at a home on Horizon Hills in unincorporated El Cajon near Mount Helix. We'll have highlights from a hearing before a San Diego judge on one of those proposed placements in this family neighborhood, as well as information on how you can share public comments by Monday's deadline on a second predator proposed for release in the same household. Plus, hear why County Supervisor Joel Anderson says his second supervisorial district is being unfairly burdened with over two-thirds of the sexually violent predators released in our region, while two other districts have none. From Public News Service, we'll then have some top national stories, including details on President Biden's Earth Day announcement of plans to hold a virtual climate summit, and passage by the House of Representatives of a bill that would grant statehood to Washington, D.C., a measure that's been opposed by all Republicans. We'll also have details on several bills that aim to reform California's controversial recall provisions for state officials. La Mesa City Council has passed a resolution seeking to improve vaccine equity by June 15th, the date known as Juneteenth. Hear why on today's show. Ranchita's only grocery store, the Manzanita Valley Market, known for its iconic Yeti statue, has burned to the ground, though the statue remains. Now, hear about a fundraising effort to help its owners, both of whom are veterans, rebuild the store. The COVID-19 pandemic has now claimed over 3 million lives worldwide. We took a look at how that compares to other pandemics throughout history and also how the U.S. is faring on getting people vaccinated, as well as how California and San Diego County are doing on this front as we begin to emerge from lockdowns. Then on Destination East County, we'll have a special report on the Anza Borrego Desert in Borrego Springs, popular destinations each spring, with attractions ranging from bighorn sheep to desert wildflowers. San Diego State University is planning to hold in-person graduation ceremonies and return to live instruction this fall, and we'll have details. Then on People Power, hear how a Border Patrol agent and an off-duty firefighter saved a life recently at the Pine Valley Bridge. On Sounds of History, in honor of Women's History Month in April, we'll tell you about Helen Stoddard, a suffragist and an amazing woman who fought to win women the right to vote in California, also helping attain cityhood for La Mesa. Then we'll take you on the road to the Campo Stone Store, a historic landmark that was once the site of a famous gun battle and now houses a museum honoring the Buffalo Soldiers. As springtime weather warms up on Ready, Set, Grow, Master Gardener Connie Beck will have some tips for you on how to avoid common gardening mistakes. And finally, we'll have some grilling safety tips for you before you fire up the barbecue for your family and friends. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
California civil rights groups say they were relieved to hear the three guilty verdicts in the Derek Chauvin trial on Tuesday, and they're vowing to continue the fight for racial justice. The jury in Minneapolis convicted former officer Derek Chauvin on all counts for killing George Floyd last May by kneeling on his neck for more than 9 minutes. Rick Callender with the California-Hawaii State Conference of the NAACP says if the verdict had gone the other way, the state and the nation would have seen an explosion of rage and grief.
Our very right to breathe was on trial, and justice has really been served, and the verdict demonstrates our accountability.
Several years ago, after the police killing of Stephon Clark in Sacramento, California lawmakers passed Assembly Bill 392, which established a tougher standard to justify use of deadly force by police. The wording of the standard went from reasonable fear to necessary in defense of human life. Callender says much more still needs to be done to further the cause of racial justice.
We need to have an end to qualified immunity, which protects government officials from lawsuits seeking monetary damages. We need to open up the records of police officers so that punishments that have been placed on their records can be considered going forward.
Chauvin faces up to 40 years in prison for the most serious charge of second-degree murder. The other Minneapolis police officers in the case go on trial later this year. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Local social justice advocates are voicing gratitude for the jury in Minneapolis that found former police officer Derek Chauvin guilty on all three counts in the death of George Floyd, including second and third degree murder, as well as manslaughter charges. But activists also caution that more action is needed to bring about reforms in policing to prevent future injustices. After video of Floyd's death under the knee of Officer Chauvin on May 25, 2020, went viral on social media, protests erupted nationwide, including San Diego. Here in East County, major protests were held in La Mesa, Santee, and El Cajon. Francine Maxwell, president of the NAACP in San Diego, calls the verdict, quote, a step in the right direction. In her statement, she adds, this has taught my son today what hope looks like, that when police don't obey the law, this is what justice looks like. Racial justice advocate Tasha Williamson, who organized protests over Floyd's killing last year, including the May 30th event in La Mesa, urged racial justice supporters to, quote, come out of your home and into the streets after the verdict. But she posted on Facebook, this is not a celebration. Racism did not die with this verdict, adding that Chauvin still faces sentencing and three other officers have trials pending. Shane Harris, president and founder of the People's Association of Justice Advocates, traveled to Minneapolis last year, where he met with Floyd's family and participated in a march. East County Magazine covered his visit in depth. More recently, his organization has joined with others to send a letter to San Diego Sheriff William Gore, County Board of Supervisors Chairman Nathan Fletcher, and the San Diego County Law Enforcement Review Board, calling for data on how many sheriff's officers have two or more sustained use of force incidents on their record, how many of those officers have been involved in shootings, and more. Harris says, quote, reimagining policing is also about protecting the taxpayer, as well as families who lose their loved ones to police violence. Harris concludes, the reality is that any city can have a Derek Chauvin, so we need to be more proactive in weeding out those cops ahead of the next black man who is killed by a police officer. Who is the Derek Chauvin in your town? Request the data, do the analysis, bring forth actionable policy, and then end the problem. This epidemic has to end, he concludes. Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs praised the verdict as sending an important message of accountability, but notes that for decades, videos have documented abuse of black people by police. She wants to see federal legislation passed to implement changes nationally. Last month, the House passed the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, a bill to reform a broken system, the Congresswoman notes, adding, it's time for the Senate to pass the bill and for all of us to start the hard work of doing right by black Americans. Black lives matter, and George Floyd should still be here. Republican Congressman Daryl Issa, whose district also includes much of East County, has not issued a statement on the verdict as of our show taping deadline. Amar Campanajar, who ran unsuccessfully against Issa in the 2020 election, posted on his Facebook, there is something broken about justice when it means a black man is killed and his murderer lives on in prison. That's not equity or full justice, but at least it's accountability and closure for the Floyd family. Now, Congress must act to fix this broken system. Genevieve Jones Wright, former candidate for district attorney, posted on Facebook that more must be done to change our policing system. She says, we must have real accountability, robust oversight, and authentic transparency. We must put up a wall between district attorney's offices and law enforcement so that they actually prosecute these murders with vigor and skill and to the fullest extent of the law. Sheriff Bill Gore noted that Floyd's death sparked widespread anger around the world. In a statement, Gore urged those celebrating or protesting the verdict to do so, quote, peacefully and with respect to other people and property. He said the sheriff will protect the fundamental right to peacefully assemble and the right to freedom of speech and expression, but adds, If you are participating in a demonstration and are asked by law enforcement to leave the area, please do so. If you witness a violent act or destruction of property, please move to a safe place and report it. National leaders have also spoken out. In an address to the nation, President Joe Biden called systemic racism, quote, a stain on our nation's soul, the knee on the neck of justice for Black Americans. President Biden called Floyd's death a murder in the full light of day that ripped the blinders off for the whole world to see the systemic racism. Vice President Kamala Harris, the first Black woman elected to the high office, tweeted, Black Americans and Black men in particular have been treated throughout the course of our country as less than human, adding, we're all a part of George Floyd's legacy and our job now is to honor it. She called for passage of the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act by the Senate, which aims to hold police departments accountable and to end racial profiling. Former President Barack Obama issued a statement saying the jury did the right thing to see that justice was done in the Chauvin case. But he reflects, true justice requires that we come to terms with the fact that Black Americans are treated differently every day. It requires us to recognize that millions of our friends, family, and fellow citizens live in fear that their next encounter with law enforcement could be their last. The nation's first Black president called for reforms to end racial bias in our criminal justice system and expand economic opportunity for marginalized communities. And he concludes, as we continue the fight, we can draw strength from the millions of people, especially young people, who have marched and protested and spoken up over the last year, shining a light on inequity and calling for change. Justice is closer today not simply because of this verdict, but because of their work. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Jonathan Goetz.
Thousands of residents have signed petitions, sent letters, or testified against the proposed placement of sexually violent predator Douglas Badger at a home on Horizon Hills in unincorporated El Cajon near Mount Helix. While the community awaits the judge's decision on proposed release of Badger, which would be supervised by Liberty Healthcare, placement of a second sexually violent predator, Merle Wakefield, at the same address has triggered new concerns and a Saturday rally to oppose the placement. Comments on placement of Wakefield are due by Monday, April 26th, and can be sent to sdsafe@sdsheriff.org or by calling 858-495-3619. During an April 20th hearing before Superior Court Judge Theodore Weathers, Supervisor Joel Anderson testified that his East County District 2 has become, quote, the dumping ground for the worst sexual offenders. He notes that other districts continue to get a pass. Anderson provided a chart showing that 67% of sexually violent predators released in San Diego County have been placed in District 2 here in East County. District 4, by contrast, has 25%, District 1 has 8%, while Districts 3 and 5 have 0 sexually violent predators. According to the Grossmont Mount Helix Improvement Association, Judge Weathers has been sent two petitions in opposition to Badger's placement, one with over 1,700 digital signatures and the other with 500 signatures. In addition, more than 600 people sent emails, 100 left voicemails, and over 400 people attended a rally April 6 opposing Badger's placement. Badger has been classified as a sexual sadist as well as a sexually violent predator, and he's been deemed likely to reoffend. He's been convicted of crimes against 9 young people, including males and females. His crimes ranged from rape to sexual molestation to sexually assaulting hitchhikers at gunpoint. Wakefield has been convicted of lewd acts with a child under 14, as well as a later felony rape conviction. Both of these men spent time in prisons and state hospitals before petitioning for supervised release and winning approval from the Department of State Hospitals. Over 40 people spoke at the hearing on Badger's proposed release. Badger, who is 78 years old, would be released under supervision of Liberty Healthcare, including GPS monitoring and accompaniment by a staffer if he must leave the residence. Liberty Healthcare's regional coordinator, Kim Cottle, testified, we are confident we can safely manage this person, both monitoring his supervision as well as treating him in the community. But Badger and Wakefield's record of violent predatory crimes has neighbors deeply concerned. David Richard, posted a photo on Facebook showing the backs of several dozen children, hands joined, in front of the proposed residence. He says all of them live within walking distance of the house, adding, "This is who we're fighting for." Some residents gave emotional testimony of past abuse of family members and the fear triggered by this proposed placement of sexually violent predators near their homes. Teresa Kemper, superintendent of the Grossmont Union High School District, said the proposed release site has three elementary schools and a high school within 3 miles. She voiced her view that this placement would cause grave consequences. Among the most compelling testimony came from Kathleen Hedberg, president of the Grossmont Mount Helix Improvement Association. Hedberg asserted that laws had been violated. She urged the judge to reject the placement because, she says, the county did not designate a county agency or program to provide assistance in determining an appropriate location for Mr. Badger, as state law requires, and because Liberty Healthcare did not reach out to the community. Second, Hedberg said the proposed placement also violates a state requirement to consider the age and profile of victims, all of whom were young in Badger's case. Proposed placement in a neighborhood with 89 children that live within 2,000 feet of the property is in conflict with the victim age and profile requirements of the placement statute, she testified, adding, there are 6 schools and 3 parks within 1 mile of the house with over 700 students at Fuerte Elementary School, and there is a daycare located right across the street. Hedberg voiced support for a proposal made by State Senator Brian Jones in a letter to Governor Gavin Newsom. Jones asked the governor to override the State Department of Hospitals decision and require that Badger be housed in a trailer at a state correctional facility, noting that 2 past governors have made similar decisions. Some neighbors have targeted the home's owner, Giovanni Spinali, voicing frustration at what they consider his lack of consideration for their concerns over safety of young people and potential impacts on property values. Some have contacted Spinali, his family members, and even sponsors of his racing events to apply pressure on him to withdraw his home from consideration for placement, which is allowed by the Department of State Hospitals. Some residents are also weighing legal action to prevent the community from having to mobilize over and over again to propose predator placements at the site. Carl Jarrus posted in the Nextdoor forum, the only way to stop this for good is to prepare for civil action against Spinali. If he does this for profit, we take that profit away, he concluded. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the mountains to the sea.
Next up, we have some national news from Public News Service, and then we'll be back for more local news from East County Magazine.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
No nation can solve this crisis on our own.
President Joe Biden announced a bold goal at day one of a virtual climate summit with 40 world leaders.
The United States sets out on the road to cut greenhouse gases in half by the end of this decade.
Meanwhile, at a House hearing on the impact of fossil fuels on climate change, 18-year-old Swedish activist Greta Thunberg chided the U.S. over fossil fuel subsidies and called on U.S. leaders to step up their efforts to cut carbon emissions.
We, the young people, are the ones who are going to write about you in the history books. We are the ones who get to decide how you will be remembered. So my advice for you is to choose wisely.
Republicans vowed to fight Biden's plans to shift to renewable energy from coal and fossil fuels. In the Senate, Republicans unveiled their counteroffer to the president's $2.3 trillion American Jobs Plan. Mississippi Republican Roger Wicker says their $568 billion plan is more narrowly focused just on physical infrastructure.
We take the part of the president's plan that most Americans agree is real hard infrastructure. We give it our touch. And we think we have a very good number here.
Biden wants a corporate tax rate of 28% to help pay for infrastructure, but the GOP plan would preserve the 2017 corporate tax rate of 21%. A bill denouncing discrimination against Asian communities passed the Senate on Thursday. Here's the bill's sponsor, Democrat Mazie Hirono of Hawaii.
As important as the content and substance of the bill is the message of this bill that we in the Senate are going to stand with our AAPI community and indeed any community that is discriminated against on the basis of race or any of the categories that you and I can think of.
Missouri Republican Josh Hawley, the lone dissenting vote, argued the bill was too broad. Four Republican amendments did not make it into the legislation, including one restricting federal funding for colleges that discriminate against Asian Americans in admissions. The House passed a D.C. statehood bill, but not without controversy. Democrat Mondaire Jones of New York accused Republicans of using racist arguments against statehood, sparking an eruption in the chamber.
One of my House Republican colleagues said that D.C. shouldn't be a state because the district doesn't have a landfill. My goodness, with all the racist trash my colleagues have brought to this debate, I can see why they're worried about having a place to put it.
Republicans immediately demanded that Jones' words be struck, and the freshman congressman agreed. The bill faces an uphill battle for Senate passage, which would likely require ending the filibuster. Federal prosecutors expect to charge at least 100 more people in connection with the January 6 riot at the U.S. Capitol. 400 people have already been charged in what will likely be one of the largest prosecutions in American history. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
The Manzanita Valley Market, the only grocery store in Ranchita, has long been a roadside attraction for motorists and cyclists heading to or from the Anza Borrego Desert. It's also been a popular stop for hikers on the Pacific Crest Trail to stock up on supplies or even sleep over in a bunkhouse. The market in East County's High Desert area is best known, however, for its iconic towering Yeti statue, affectionately known as Ranchetti. But on April 18th, the fire destroyed the market and also heavily damaged the Ranchita real estate office next door. The damage totaled $350,000, according to CAL FIRE. Fortunately, the Yeti statue, built by realtor Joseph Rao, survived the blaze, and no one was injured in the fire, but the loss for the market's owners, who are both veterans, is devastating. A GoFundMe site has been started by a friend to help the Manzanita Valley market's owners rebuild. The fundraising page states, "The Montezuma Valley Market is the dream of two young people who have served their country in the military and plan to be the change they want to see for the local community. They have served our community so well and never expected or even thought they would ever need anything in return. Now this family needs our help." Making matters even harder for the couple, just before the fire, they learned that their daughter has cancer and had just begun chemotherapy. So far, the site has generated around $12,000 towards their goal of $200,000. People who have made donations shared memories and posted comments thanking the owners for their support for the community. Shannon Riker posted, "Thank you for all that you do for the hiking community. We hope to see you back on your feet soon and do what you do best, putting smiles on hikers' faces." Kelly Witt commented, "I am a former San Diego County firefighter and served at the Ranchita Fire Station for a short time. Your market was always very kind to us and supported our crews. I am honored to return the favor. Best wishes to you as you look to rebuild such a wonderful asset to the community." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Mitchell Murphy. With California Governor Gavin Newsom facing a recall election, several measures have been introduced in the legislature that would make it harder to recall state officials in the future. However, State Senator Josh Newman, a Democrat, announced that he has withdrawn his Senate Bill 663, which would have required all county elections officers to publicly release the names and contact information of each voter who signs a petition to recall a state official or put an initiative on a ballot. Carl DeMaio, a Republican, former San Diego City Councilman and chairman of Reform California, a conservative politician action committee, had criticized the measure as being, quote, "designed to punish voters who dared to sign petitions on recalls and ballot measures that politicians oppose. Current law allows people who sign petitions to change their mind within 30 days. SB 663 would have extended that to 45 days, but critics argued that revealing the names of petition signers would subject them to harassment by targets of recalls or their supporters pressuring voters to change their minds. The bill would not have impacted the recall against Governor Newsom, since it would not have taken effect until next year, though 663 has been withdrawn, several other bills that would make it harder to recall officials or put measures on statewide ballot remain active in Sacramento, CalMatters reports. Senate Bill 752 by Senator Ben Allen would require that before voters sign a petition for a recall initiative or referendum, they would first have to certify that they have read a list of top financial contributors. The bill aims to prevent misrepresentation by signature gatherers, according to the author. Allen has also introduced Senate Constitutional Amendment 3, which would put the name of an official targeted for recall on the list of successor candidates. It aims to prevent a candidate from winning with only a small fraction of the vote, which can occur when many candidates are running to replace a recalled official. SEA would also cancel a recall election and save taxpayers money if a state official facing recall resigns after the measure qualifies for the ballot. In the case of a governor, the lieutenant governor would fill the governor's position. If another state official resigns, the governor would appoint a successor to fill the vacancy. One other measure, Senate Bill 660, would ban paying professional signature gatherers for recalls, initiatives, and referenda to validate laws passed by the legislature. This measure stands little chance of becoming law. However, since similar bills have been vetoed by every recent governor, including Governor Newsom, who wrote in 2019, while I appreciate the intent of this legislation to incentivize grassroots support for the initiative process, I believe these measures could make the qualification of many initiatives cost prohibitive, thereby having the opposite effect. Reporting for EastCon Magazine on KNSJ, this is Mitchell Murphy.
On April 13th, the La Mesa City Council passed a resolution proposed by Councilmembers Jack Hsu and Bill Baber to improve vaccine equity by June 19th, also known as Juneteenth. Juneteenth is a historic date that marks the official end of slavery, when Union soldiers arrived in Texas to deliver the news of freedom 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed by President Abraham Lincoln. During the La Mesa City Council meeting, Councilman Hsu said this date is the ideal goal for achieving better vaccine equity. Hsu shared county data indicating that members of the Black community are being vaccinated at much lower rates than others. He stated at the meeting, "We have enough time now to really work at it and to close the gap, so we don't have a difference between people who are protected by color, by ethnicity, by income, or where you live. We need as many people as we can and as fast as we can, but we should also be doing so equitably," he said. Councilman Hsu hopes to partner with community leaders and organizations like faith groups, educational institutions, and businesses to facilitate spread of information about the vaccine to those who may be struggling to access COVID-19 resources. He believes word-of-mouth communication, equipping teachers with up-to-date vaccine information for students to take home and share with family and friends, will be the most effective ways to get people to schedule vaccine appointments. The resolution also received support from write-in public comments, read by the city clerk. Community member Melissa Walter wrote, "Please pass this resolution to commit to the health and safety of all La Mesa neighbors. If we work together as a community, this can happen," she said. The resolution passed unanimously with wide support from all other council members. The meeting was the last for Councilmember Akila Weber, who is also a medical doctor recently elected to fill a vacancy in the state assembly. She said of the resolution, "I think this is an amazing first step. We all know about the inequalities within our healthcare system, which we are also seeing with vaccine distribution." Dr. Weber, who is Black, concluded, "My challenge would be not to just think about this resolution, but what are the next steps?" Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery. Over 3 million people have now died of COVID-19 worldwide, according to the World Health Organization, including over 550,000 deaths in the United States, the most of any nation. The novel coronavirus has infected more than 141 million people around the world, including over 37 million U.S. cases. So, how does the COVID-19 pandemic stack up against other historic outbreaks? And how did those earlier pandemics end? Well, we took a look. The flu pandemic of 1918 to 20 was even more destructive, killing an estimated 20 to 50 million people worldwide, including 675,000 Americans. That pandemic infected more than a third of the world's population due to its higher fatality rate of up to 20%. It ended due to vaccinations. The Black Death or bubonic plague ravaged Europe, Africa, and Asia in the mid-14th century, killing 200 million people. It is believed to have been transmitted from continent to continent by rats jumping merchant ships carrying fleas into port cities. An earlier pandemic, the plague of Justinian from 541 to 532 AD, was also bubonic plague. It killed 25 million people, including as many as half the population in Europe's Mediterranean port cities and the Byzantine Empire. An ancient plague in 165 AD, the Antonine Plague, killed 5 million people in Asia Minor, Egypt, Greece, and Italy, but its cause remains unknown. Roman soldiers returning from Mesopotamia brought the scourge with them, which may have been measles or possibly smallpox. The deadliest scourge in history was smallpox, which thankfully has been eliminated off the face of the earth due to an effective global vaccination strategy. First documented in Egyptian mummies from the 3rd century BC, the viral disease is estimated to have killed around 500 million people just in the last 100 years of its existence, before the last known case in 1975. Another 400,000 people died in the 1700s in Europe of smallpox. Throughout history, smallpox may have killed close to a billion people, more than all other infectious diseases combined as of when it was finally eradicated. In modern times, the HIV/AIDS pandemic killed 36 million people, including over 700,000 in the U.S. between 2005 and 2012. Thanks to development of new treatments, this disease has become more manageable, with most patients surviving long-term if they receive treatment. Other serious pandemics include outbreaks of cholera, notably a cholera pandemic from 1852 to 1860 that killed a million people as it spread from India through Asia, Europe, North America, and Africa. Cholera is caused by a bacterial infection in contaminated water, and it's prevented through sanitation efforts. An Asian flu pandemic from 1956 to 1958 resulted in 2 million lives lost, and the Hong Kong flu outbreak in 1968 killed 1 million people worldwide. Flu vaccines have been credited with slowing the spread of influenza worldwide, with annual booster shots targeting new strains. COVID-19 vaccines are similarly expected to help control the spread of the novel coronavirus, though it may never completely eliminate it and boosters may be required. In the U.S., 40% of people aged 16 and up have now received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, and California has fully vaccinated 25% of its population. San Diego is doing even better, with 28% of those aged 16 and up fully vaccinated, and nearly half, 48%, given at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. According to a U.S. Health and Human Services survey, which shows San Diego County has some of the highest vaccine acceptance rates in the nation, only 11% of county residents say they probably or definitely won't get the vaccine, and only 4% of San Diegans say they definitely won't get vaccinated. The Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are approximately 95% effective at preventing those vaccinated from getting the disease and nearly 100% effective at preventing serious cases or death. Johnson & Johnson's vaccine has been paused after 6 women died of a rare blood clotting complication, but that's out of more than 6 million doses administered in the U.S. Now, protecting your health is not the only incentive for getting vaccinated. In California, major events such as concerts, sports, weddings, and private events are allowed to resume, provided participants show proof of vaccination or proof of a recent negative COVID-19 test. Joyful Padres fans have been flocking back to the stadium, with vaccinated fans allocated to a special section to watch one of the team's best seasons in memory. Proof of vaccination may also be required to travel to certain countries as the world emerges from the pandemic. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, Get trained to be a citizen journalist and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Welcome to Destination East County with your hosts, Rebecca Williamson
and Jonathan Getz, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
With spring in full gear, this week's Destination East County spotlights Borrego Springs. I'm Jonathan Getz, your host. Special thanks to contributors of the Borrego Springs portion of our Weekend Getaways coverage, Miriam Raftery, Bobby Zane, Liz Orient, and myself, Jonathan Getz. Located in the heart of the Anza-Borrego Desert, in the furthest east reach of San Diego County, Borrego Springs is a place where visitors are surrounded by nature, can stargaze in an internationally designated dark skies region, enjoy spring wildflowers, visit the largest state park in California, gaze at whimsical statues across the desert, and also find cultural attractions from art shows to musical programs in a performing arts center. Spring is a great time to visit the desert. Not everything is open due to COVID-19, so be sure to call first to verify your itinerary and be flexible. The Borrego Springs Chamber of Commerce website lists an activities calendar and a things to do section with options such as birding, bicycling, off-roading, desert hiking, golf, tennis, and a lot more. Anza-Borrego State Park is the largest state park in California with 500 miles of dirt roads, 12 wilderness areas, many hiking trails, washes, wildflowers, palm groves, cacti, and sweeping vistas. Visitors may also glimpse roadrunners, golden eagles, kit foxes, mule deer, and bighorn sheep, as well as iguanas, chicuelas, and the red diamond rattlesnakes. The park is named for Spanish explorer Juan Bautista de Anza and the Spanish and Arabic word borrego for sheep. Lodging options in Borrego Springs range from luxurious resorts such as La Casa de Zorro to historical properties, camping in vintage trailers and RV camping, such as at the Palm Canyon Hotel and RV Resort. Desert USA offers weekly updates on wildflower viewing places each spring. Always carry plenty of water when traveling in the desert, and make sure your vehicle has a full tank of gas. Convenience stores in Borrego Springs can be kind of expensive as everything has to be trucked in, so consider packing a cooler to take with you, bring sunscreen, sunglasses, and, if hiking, wear sturdy shoes, and keep an eye and ear out for scorpions and snakes. Stay on trails to avoid trampling fragile, beautiful desert blooms. While you're there, consider checking out the world-renowned metal sculptures at Gaieta Meadows. The 130-plus life-sized permanent sculptures are the brainchild of Ricardo Braceda, some of which are typically for sale in Christmas Circle in the middle of town. Within Anza-Borrego State Park, there are numerous trails for hikers to explore. The most well-known route is a moderate 3-mile loop called Palm Canyon Trail. A docent advised that the palm tree oasis and fresh spring water are well worth the effort. The trail is also a prime location for bighorn sheep sightings, although these sightings are more common in the summer when there are fewer humans around and the bighorn sheep have to travel farther for food and water. Find this information and more at eastcountymagazine.org, subsection under Best of East County, Weekend Getaways, or search term Weekend Getaways.
See you around, East County.
Things are looking brighter for the San Diego State community now that the county has shifted to the orange tier. The SDSU Commencement Committee confirmed via email that spring commencement ceremonies will be conducted in person for those who choose to register. Graduation ceremonies will be held May 25th through 27th at Petco Park Stadium downtown. For those who choose not to attend, SDSU will also provide a virtual ceremony, and these options will be available to both the graduating classes of 2020 and 2021. there's more good news for students on the horizon. University leaders announced that SDSU is planning to offer primarily in-person instruction for the fall semester instead of the previously planned hybrid model. On-campus housing will also be reopened to thousands of students now that California's Governor Gavin Newsom has announced plans to fully reopen the state's economy on June 15th. Newsom stated, "I want kids back in school safely for in-person instruction. On June 15th, we anticipate there will be no barrier to getting all of our kids safely back. That includes K-12 as well as community colleges and universities," the governor added. For students who plan on returning to San Diego State's campus for classes, no specific requirements and guidelines have yet been announced, besides a mask mandate, though the university is monitoring county guidelines closely to establish safe and effective policies. According to a campus-wide email, some of those policies may include proof of vaccination, continued COVID-19 testing and contact tracing, wastewater testing, enhanced cleaning protocols, and quarantine housing. SDSU's Love Library will be partly reopened starting May 24th, and registration for the fall semester will begin May 25th. While the community has mixed feelings about the safety of reopening and going back to in-person instruction, University President Adela De La Torre, Associated Students President Christian Holt, and other campus leaders have all voiced confidence in the transition and remain optimistic about students returning to campus in the fall. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is East County Magazine's People Power, profiling local people making a positive difference in our community and our world.
This is Mitchell Murphy with a People Power Report. A San Diego Border Patrol agent and an off-duty firefighter saved a life when they prevented a woman from jumping off the Pine Valley Bridge. Around 7 a.m., the Border Patrol agent was driving east on Interstate 8 when he saw the woman standing on the rails of the Pine Valley Bridge. The agent quickly turned around and was joined by an off-duty firefighter. The agent and firefighter physically removed the woman from the edge of the bridge and secured her for her safety, according to a press release issued by the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol. The woman was later transferred to the California Highway Patrol for care and assistance. Chief Border Patrol Agent Aaron says a tragedy was avoided thanks to the effort of the men he hailed as heroes. The Pine Valley Bridge is 440 feet high with a 450-foot span, one of the highest bridges in the United States, but tragically, it has been the scene of many suicides through the years. If you are suffering from depression, there is help available. For immediate help during a crisis, you can call 911 or call the San Diego Access and Crisis Hotline at 888-724-7240. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ 89.1 FM, this is Mitchell Murphy.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society bringing you the sounds of history.
This is Miriam Raftery, guest hosting the Sounds of History on the East County Magazine show. April is Women's History Month. It's an appropriate time to share a story about a remarkable woman from East County's past. Helen Stoddard, a former resident of La Mesa, Lemon Grove, and Ramona, was a prominent leader in the fight to win women the right to vote, as well as in the temperance movement. She even earned a place in history at the national political level. Born in 1850 in Wisconsin, Stoddard earned a teaching degree at Genesee Wesleyan Seminary in New York, graduating as valedictorian in 1873. She married Shepherd Stoddard and had two sons, one of whom died in infancy. They lived briefly in Nebraska, but soon her husband's health was failing, so the family moved to Florida. And after he died in 1875, when Helen Stoddard was just 25 years old, she and her surviving young son moved to Texas to be near her parents. There, she became president of the Texas State Chapter of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, concerned over the negative impacts of alcoholism on women and their families. She also served on the faculty of Fort Worth University and helped establish a women's industrial arts college that today is known as Texas Women's University, where two buildings were named after her. She became an activist, lobbying successfully for a pure food law and laws against cocaine, gambling, child labor, raising the age of protection for girls from 12 to 15 in Texas, and more. She spent 3 months in Mexico as an organizer and twice served as a delegate to World Conventions of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. She also wrote an article on the Texas suffrage movement for Susan B. Anthony's book, History of Woman Suffrage. In 1910, Helen Stoddard and her son moved to La Mesa, where she was soon elected president of the La Mesa Women's Club, which incidentally was founded in 1902 and is the city's oldest active service club today. She also headed up the local chapter of the Women's Christian Temperance Society, forerunner of the Prohibition movement. Local women embarked on barnstorming tours across the county to win support from men for women to gain the right to vote in California. La Mesa's newspaper and other local papers editorialized in favor of granting this right, since progressives in the region recognized that women would be key allies in local political issues and supporting social reforms related to child labor, public health, and regulating alcohol and vice. The La Mesa Scout editorialized that the right of women to vote is as absolute as that of a man. In October 1911, California's legislature amended the state constitution, granting women the right to vote. Days later, Helen Stoddard loaded up motor cars with about 40 members of the La Mesa Women's Club and headed to the Registrar of Voters' office in downtown San Diego, registering them all to vote. In La Mesa, then known as La Mesa Springs, a battle was brewing over incorporation to become a city. Supporters wanted the city to control its own water supply and support public education, among other goals. But there was strong opposition, mainly from ranchers who feared that their taxes would go up. Early efforts at incorporation faltered until the women got involved and won the right to vote. A meeting at the La Mesa Opera House on December 1, 1911, ended in disorder without a vote on whether to incorporate after vocal opponents showed up. Supporters brought their case to the supervisors, and among the speakers arguing to the supervisors was suffrage leader Helen Stoddard. The district attorney reviewed the petition but rejected it at first for not meeting requirements to publish notices 3 times over 2 weeks. So the supporters circulated a new petition and adjusted boundaries to remove some of their key opponents. In February 1912, a new meeting was convened at the city's Opera House, a building that today is the Por Favor restaurant in downtown La Mesa. Citizens nominated candidates for public office in case the incorporation petition passed, and Helen Stoddard was nominated to serve, but she declined. Turned out she had higher ambitions, and we'll tell you about that in a minute. On February 7, 1912, a special election was held, and the incorporation measure passed, with help from La Mesa's newly registered women. Soon after, Stoddard declared her intention to run for Congress on the Prohibition Party ticket. She was the first woman in California to seek national office. Her campaign targeted women with the slogan, "A vote for Helen Stoddard is a vote for the home." She didn't win, but she did draw over 1,300 votes out of over 20,000 cast for 5 candidates in the race. A year later, she and her son Robert and his wife moved to Lemon Grove, where they spent the next 10 years, and in 1923, they moved to Ramona, where her son raised turkeys and chickens, while his mother continued her work in the temperance movement from their home overlooking the Ramona High School. In 1920, Helen Stoddard was elected president of the California State Chapter of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, and she served as a California delegate to the Congress Against Alcoholism in Washington, D.C. After her son's death in 1936 in Ramona, Stoddard and her daughter-in-law moved to Texas. Helen Stoddard died there in January 1941 at age 90, and her body was returned to San Diego for burial next to her son at Greenwood Memorial Park. She had lived through the Civil War, the Spanish-American War, World War I, and the dawn of World War II. Born in the pioneer era, in her lifetime she advanced education of women and saw women win the right to vote, helped lead the successful fight for La Mesa to become a city, ran for national political office, fought for the passage of the Prohibition Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, but also lived to see that repealed. Throughout her life, she was a tireless fighter for the rights of women and girls, touching the lives of people across our nation to this day. Next up from County News Service, we're going to be hearing from Larry Johnson out at the old Campo Stone Store, one of East County's most unique and colorful historical landmarks.
If you're ever on Highway 94, about an hour east of San Diego, you might see this unique building.
Welcome to historic Campo and the Gaskell Brothers Stone Store Museum.
The Gaskell Brothers built a fortress-like stone store in 1885. Previously, it was a wooden structure, the site of a famous shootout.
A group of bandits had been raiding down the coast of California, so gunfire started. And there was a big shootout. The guy that they had shot on the floor, one of the Gaskell brothers, didn't kill him. He jumped up, grabbed a shotgun, went out and shot people. And so they were shooting dead blank range around. And both Gaskell brothers were wounded. The locals were afraid of another raid. They couldn't get the military up here to guard and protect them. So they thought they needed a substantial building. So that's why they decided to build a building as thick as this and as strong as this. If you take a look around, if you come in, you'll see that the walls down here are about 4 foot thick. It's from stone that was quarried here on site by hand with hammer and drill and no backhoes or heavy lifting objects. It was manpower. It served as a store from 1885 until about 1927.
No longer a store, this building is now a museum, thanks to County Parks and the Mountain Empire Historical Society. Today, the store reflects the early life of the town of Campo.
When the Historical Society began, they tried to make it look a lot like it did in 1899, or when it was a store functioning to serve the local public. So they have gathered some of the food stuff, the tobaccos, the medical supplies, the ropes, the cans, anything that the ranchers needed. If they didn't have it, you didn't need it.
The building is filled with photos, books, artifacts from the Kumeyaay Indians who occupied the region prior to the settlers, and other rare items.
These shackles were found locally about 3 miles from here on a ranch in about 1885. A person who's bought the ranch found in the well the skeleton. On the skeleton, on the legs, were these shackles. They didn't know who the body was or who the skeleton was. It's still a mystery today. One of the interesting things about these shackles is they're blacksmith made. There's no lock to them. Once they were on, they were meant to stay.
Upstairs is an impressive exhibit dedicated to Campo's military history, including Camp Lockett.
Camp Lockett was started before the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. I guess the military was anticipating that there was going to be a war, and they needed another base here, and they needed a base in this area because of the railroad, which was a key supply line. We had a long exposed border, and one of the things they were afraid of was that if the Japanese came into the war, they might invade Mexico and come into San Diego. So this was sort of a critical point, and so they started building Camp Lockett.
The 10th Cavalry is one you may have heard of.
The famed Buffalo Soldiers, white officers and an African-American enlisted troops. And they were stationed here, and they were guarding tunnels and railroad and the border. Very tough, very good soldiers.
The museum is open on weekends, making for a nice day trip to learn about our local pioneers.
They were entrepreneurs, every one of them. They were constantly trying to figure out how to make the best of what they had and where they were, and to make a living and to leave history and substantial items behind them so that descendants would have something to live and work on and hopefully try and take care of.
This is Connie Beck with Ready, Set, Grow. I'm going to help you create healthy and beautiful gardens using less money, less hard work, and much more fun. I thought this time I would talk about the biggest mistakes that homemakers make. And I think one of the first ones, and I find this when I go to people's houses to do a consultation, is I ask them what their goal is. Frequently, they know. And that's awesome when they tell me, I just don't want to pay this much for water anymore, but I don't want a desert look. Those are two really good clues for me. That tells me, okay, we're going with either native or Mediterranean plants. We're going to mulch everything. We're going to put in drip irrigation. And I know where to go from there. Unfortunately, a lot of people go to the nursery before they know what their real goal is. And if you don't have a clear goal, you're not going to have a good plan for how to achieve that goal. You can't also come up with your goal and then your little sketch and your plan and then go straight to the nursery. It would be great if it was that easy. We would all love it. But you have to do the soil preparation first. You have to address the drainage issues first. And then you also have to know something about plants. At this point, if you don't own a Sunset Western Garden book, you better get one. And you better start checking what you've come up with for a plant list. How you don't do it is you don't go to the nursery and buy everything you see that's pink, that's pretty. That doesn't work. You need to know what these plants want in the way of sun exposure, watering, how big will they grow. I have seen people plant
shrubs that are going to become 10 feet tall and 10 feet wide, and they have put 8 of them in a 10 foot by 10 foot square. That doesn't work. So you need to know about the plants. You need to know water. You need to know sun or shade. You need to know what kind of soil they like. If you're planning to have a blueberry farm, you better make adjustments ahead of time for the soil. You need not to think so much about the color of the plants, because that's one of the last considerations. You also need to plan for maintenance down the line. You need to have somebody come in and do a good job of pruning on your trees. You need to put in good mulch so that the plants will not be stressed out by too much heat. You don't want to use unrelated plant materials.
I hate it when I go to somebody's house and they tell me that they're going to hand water every
landscape on one side of the driveway and a Japanese garden on the other side.
You really do. If you have more than one flower bed that's very small,
put in an irrigation system. And my favorite for everything is drip irrigation of some sort. Too many accessories, aka yard art. Be careful. It can start looking very junky very quickly. Basically, if you stand there and look at an area of your yard, you shouldn't see more than one piece of yard art in that field of vision. And then the last thing I would mention, if you're doing a design-it-yourself situation, make sure people can find your front door. You should have a friendly, colorful walkway to the front door so that people don't stand there wondering which way they should go. You can do that by outlining that walkway with bright colored perennials, putting in a few landscape lights, a few, it shouldn't look like a landing strip, and then have a welcome that everybody will enjoy. You too.
This is Ed Barreno with East County Magazine on KNSJ with some grilling safety tips. Fire Chief Sam DiGiovanna, East County Magazine's in-house fire chief and columnist, says that firefighters respond to many structure and wild land fires that involve barbecues around this time of year. He adds, quote, "We also treat many victims for injuries related to barbecues. Barbecue safety means sending the right smoke signal, and that signal is safety," unquote. While gas grills contribute to a higher number of home fires than their charcoal counterparts, all grills pose a risk for fires and burns. Grills should be placed well away from the home and decks, far from under the eaves or overhanging branches and vegetation. Other grilling safety tips from the National Fire Protection Association are as follows. 1. Propane and charcoal grills should only be used outdoors. 2. Keep children and pets at least 3 feet away from the grilling area. 3. Keep your grill clean by removing grease or fat buildup from the grills and in trays below the grill. 4. Never leave your grill unattended. Always make sure your gas grill lid is open before igniting it. 5. If you smell gas while cooking, immediately get away from the grill and call the fire department. Do not move the grill. If the flame goes out, turn the grill and gas off and wait at least 15 minutes before relighting it. 6. When using a starter fluid, use only charcoal starter fluid. Never add any other flammable liquids to the fire. Keep charcoal fluid out of the reach of children and away from heat sources. When you are finished grilling, let the coals completely cool before disposing of them in a metal container. And finally, use common sense and grill safely.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, AK Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.